Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 9th canto, chapter 20. We're going to start with text 34, and I'm actually going to go through right till the end of the chapter. And the verse we will chant together, I guess, will be number, 36. We could chant together, and then I'll just read through. Okay, so I'll just start. I'll chant 34, 35, and we'll chant 36 together.
Tasya sanirpa vidarbhya patnyas tisra sumanmata jaghus tyaga biat putran nanurupa iti rite.
Translation. O King Prickett, Maharaj Bharat had three pleasing wives who were daughters of the king of Vidarbha. When all three of them bore children who did not resemble the king, these wives thought that he would consider them unfaithful queens and reject them, and therefore they killed their own sons. Okay, text 35.
Tashyaivam vittatevamse tadartam yajata sutam marutstomena marutu baradvajam upadadu.
Translation: the king, his attempt for progeny frustrated in this way, performed the sacrifice named Marutstoma to get a son. The demigods known as the Maruts, being fully satisfied with him, then presented him a son named Bharadvaj. Now we're going to hear the background story to that. That's the rest of the chapter, pretty much. Okay, we'll chant this one together.
Antarvatnyam bratir patnyam. Antarvatnyam bratir patnyam. Maitunaya brihaspati. Maitunaya brihaspati. Pravrito varito garbham. Pravrito varito garbham. Saptva viryam upasrichat. Saptva viryam upasrichat. Antarvantyam bratir patnyam. Maitunaya brihaspati. Pravrito varito garbham. Saptvaviram upasrijat.
Others.
Vaishnavis.
Antavatnyam.
Pregnant.
Bhatrir Patnyam.
With the brother's wife.
Maitunaya.
Desiring sexual enjoyment.
Brihaspati.
The demigod named Brihaspati.
Pravrata.
So inclined.
Bharita.
When forbidden to do so.
Garbham.
The sun within the abdomen.
Sapva.
By cursing.
Viryam.
Semen.
Upasrijat.
Discharged.
Translation.
When the demigod named Brihaspati was attracted by his brother's wife,
Mamata,
who at the time was pregnant, he desired to have sexual relations with her. The sun within her womb forbid this, but Brihaspati cursed him and forcibly discharged semen into the womb of Mamata. Purport. The sex impulse is so strong in this material world that even Brihaspati, who is supposed to be the priest of the demigods and a very learned scholar, wanted to have sexual relationship with his brother's pregnant wife. This can happen even in the society of the higher demigods, so what to speak of human society? The sex impulse is so strong that it can agitate even a learned personality like Brihaspati. Now I'm going to read the rest. Okay, this is not much.
Tam tyak tu kamam mamatam bartus tyaga visankitam nama nirvachanam tasya shlokam inam sura jagu.
Translation. Mamata very much feared being forsaken by her husband for giving birth to an illegitimate son. And therefore she considered giving up the child. But then the demigods solved the problem by enunciating a name for the child.
Purport.
According to the Vedic scripture, whenever a child is born, there are some ceremonies known as Jatakarma and Namakarana, in which learned brahmanas, immediately after the birth of the child, make a horoscope according to the astrological calculations. But the child to which Mamata gave birth was begotten by Brihaspati irreligiously. For although Mamata was the wife of Uttatya, Brihaspati made her pregnant by force. Therefore, Brihaspati became Bharta. According to Vedic culture, a wife is considered the property of her husband, and a son born by illicit sex is called Dvaja. The common words still current in Hindu society for such a son is Dogla, which refers to a son not begotten by the husband of his mother. In such a situation, it is difficult to give the child a name according to the proper regulative principles. Mamata, therefore, was perplexed, but the demigods gave the child the appropriate name, Bharadvaj, which indicated that the child born illegitimately should be maintained by both Mamata and Brihaspati. Text 38.
Mude Bharadvajam imam Bharadvajam Brihaspate Yato Yad Ukva Pitaro Bharadvajas Tatatvayam.
Translation. Brihaspati said to Mamata, "You foolish woman, although this child was born from the wife of one man through the semen discharged by another, you should maintain him." Upon hearing this, Mamata replied, "O Brihaspati, you maintain him." After speaking in this way, Brihaspati and Mamata both left. Thus the child was born, just the child was known as Bharadvaj. In the last translation of the chapter.
Chodyamana surar evam atva vitatam atmajam vyasrajan marato biblan dato yam vitaten baye.
Although encouraged by the demigods to maintain the child, Mamata considered him useless because of his illicit birth, and therefore she left him. Consequently, the demigods known as the Maruts maintained the child. And when Maharaj Bharat was disappointed for want of a child, this child was given to him as his son. And in a very brief purport by Srila Prabhupada, from this verse it is understood that those who are rejected from the higher planetary system are given a chance to take birth in the most exalted families of this planet.
Om Aginatamananda Shajananjana Shalakaya Chakshuna Militam Yena Tasma Shri Gudavena Maha Shri Chaitanya Mano Prishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Upakaramayam Dadati Swapadantikam.
Okay. So before I launch into, or I'm not even saying I'm going to, but one might launch into a conventional type of presentation here, talking about the problem that human or sexuality plays in those trying to advance in spiritual life. That would be like a very, you know, understandable way of responding to these verses and the message here. And I'll say something about that. But I want to say something also about the overall, you know, picture we're getting here, the overall scene that's taking place here, because it is very unusual. And I don't think we should just kind of glaze over, just kind of hear it and go, oh, yeah, you're right. And let's just get to it and talk about, you know, the whole sex life thing again. There's a lot of really far out things that are coming up here, being brought to light here. So I'd like to go over it one by one and kind of analyze what's really happening and think about it. I'll speak a little bit slower. Let's start with text 34. O King Pricket, Maharaj Bharat had three pleasing wives who were daughters of the king of Vidarbha. When all three of them bore children who did not resemble the king, these wives thought that he would consider them unfaithful queens and reject them, and therefore they killed their own sons. Now, that's pretty radical. I mean, isn't it? That's pretty radical. That's a pretty radical thing for even an ordinary woman in human society to do now, you know, in Kali Yuga, where we don't have very high morality or very high ethics, or people are not very, you know, high class, they're low class, mostly, you know, predominantly influenced by the modes of passion and ignorance. It's kind of like, when I read this, I was kind of shocked, because of this is not behavior I would expect of women who are elevated, you know, the members of the Vedic culture, queens of Maharaj Bharat. They weren't just like some ordinary sudras or something like that. They were the queens of Maharaj Bharat. How do we understand this? That they'd be prepared to kill their... they did it. They didn't say they were thinking about it. They did it. They killed their own sons, fearing that their husband, Maharaj Bharat, might think them unfaithful because the children didn't resemble him. Now, another point is, as I said, I don't know about anybody else, but I got to go over these kind of things when I read the Bhagavatam. I have to think about, you know, what's going on. Would Maharaj Bharat really be that upset? I mean, he's Maharaj Bharat. He's like a super elevated personality. Would he be upset to the point, you know, if the kids didn't resemble him? First off, another point is, when a child is born, they practically don't even look like a human being. How could you tell that, you know, how can you tell whether the kid even looks like the father or the mother or not? I can't. You can start telling after a few years or something like that, but when they're just like an infant like that, they just look like a lump of, you know, they don't look like anything as far anybody, you know, as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, so they were. But this is what they this was their fear. So that's strange, you know. I mean that Maharaj Bharat would react to that extent, that, you know, he would be so upset with them that he would reject them because the child, the infant, who you really can't tell who he looks like anyway, didn't look like him. So this is pretty like, wow, what do you make of that? And I don't know what to make of it, really. But I will say something as I go on, how I wound up, you know, what I do wind up making of it. But anyway, let's just leave it. I just pointed out those things that, you know, it's not, you know, it's, you can't just read, and there's no comment by the acharyas. There's no purport, which means Prabhupada didn't do a purport. And if Prabhupada didn't do a purport, it means it's because the previous acharyas didn't comment on the verse. So there's no purport. So it's just left there. Okay, and we'll do the same thing. But I did point out these things. All right, so the next thing. The king, his attempt for progeny frustrated in this way, performed the sacrifice named Marut Stoma to get a son. The demigods known as the Maruts, being fully satisfied with him, then presented him with the son Bharadvaj. Okay, that's pretty straightforward. Okay, he's an earthly king, so he performed the sacrifice to the demigods. Well, we're familiar with that type of thing, you know, humans performing sacrifice and getting reciprocation from the demigods. So this is not so unusual for, you know, even for a devotee to relate to. Then now we're going to get the background story about this child, Bharadvaj. When the demigod named Brihaspati was attracted by his brother's wife, Mamata, who at that time was pregnant, he desired to have sexual relations with her. Well, now that's pretty outrageous, but once again, we can even relate to that because we hear a lot of outrageous things like this, you know, do come up in the Bhagavatam. I mean, just like in the mornings, Archie reminded me when he asked me to give the class that we've been hearing about how Lord Brahma, who's the topmost being, creature in the material universe, not just because he's first, he's the most intelligent, he's the most powerful, he is like head and shoulders above every other, so far above head and shoulders above every other demigod, it's hard to understand. I mean, Lord Brahma is really like in a very superior position to any other mortal being in this universe, and yet we hear, we're hearing in the mornings how he was attracted by his daughter, Vak, and he couldn't be dissuaded, you know, from that inclination, even by his sons, who were elevated, you know, souls themselves and presented good arguments, good reasons, but no. So anyway, so these things do come up, so that's kind of shocking, but anyway, it's not like a totally unique thing here. The son within her womb forbid this, but Prihaspati cursed him and forcibly discharged semen into the womb of Mamata. So here again, this is pretty some unusual stuff. I mean, okay, so the son is forbidding it. How does the son in the womb forbid it? I mean, you know, we it's just, if nothing else, we should be reflecting on the wild and wonderful world of the Bhagavatam. You know, like the kind of amazing, incredible things that are happening or are accommodated in this world view. I mean, the son within the womb is forbidding. He's forbidding Brihaspati to do that. Good for him. I mean, that's the right thing for him to be. But how does the son in the womb forbid somebody outside? You know. But he's doing it. And Brihaspati is aware of that somehow. And he curses him. And that's another wild thing. I mean, this Brihaspati is the priest of the demigods. You know, he's not just some ordinary criminal off the street. He's the priest of the demigods. Here he's prepared to perform this highly irreligious act. And on top of that, the son in the womb is forbidding him to do it, which, you know, one might think, well, maybe he'll take that as an omen. You know, just like in the earlier in the chapter, there was this thing where the voice from the skies came and said, who is it? Yeah, Shakuntala is your wife, and this is your son, and you should accept him. So, you know, and he took it. He didn't argue back or say, no, wait, get out of here, omen, you know. But anyway, no, Brihaspati, he didn't take that as an omen that maybe I shouldn't do this. You know, maybe I shouldn't do this. He has this, like a child within the womb is protesting. Oh, I better just back off here. I'm way off, you know. No, quite the contrary. He got angry. He got upset about the whole thing that this child is protesting, and he cursed the child in the womb. So that's pretty far out. Anyway, it goes on. And he forcibly discharged semen into the womb of Mamata. And so Prabhupada's pointing out how this kind of thing even goes on in the demigod society, what to speak of human society, and how the sex impulse is so strong that it can agitate even a learned personality like Brihaspati. So, yeah. So now just to make a comment about this, you know, the specific kind of issue that's being dealt with here, human sexuality or demigod sexuality, how it's a stumbling block on the path to self-realization. There's so many things that could be said about this, and there's so many things that already have been said about this, because this, you know, comes up pretty regularly in the Bhagavatam classes. And I'm just going to say, make one statement about it, one comment about it, which is in no way an attempt to, you know, sort of encapsulate all the different important things that could be said about this, but it's just something that just seemed very significant to me and, you know, was my immediate, like, reaction when I read this and had to think about it. Okay, so there was this one instance. Prabhupada, this is way back in the early days of ISKCON. Prabhupada was giving a class, and the subject of this came up, sexuality. And so Prabhupada was making the point. He said, sex life is allowed in Krishna consciousness. You can, you know, if you can be married, and the husband and wife can have sex life once a month, you know, for the purpose of procreation, you know, trying to have a child. So Hayagriva, at the time, he raised his hand, and this is way back in the really early days, you know, 26 Second Avenue. He raised his hand, and he said, once a month, better to forget about it altogether. And Prabhupada said, yes. Prabhupada liked that. He said, yes, very good, very intelligent, very good boy. He said, yeah, better just to tolerate the itch. And I think he made this thing like, you know, how sex life is like an itching sensation. You just better to tolerate it and it goes away. So that was Prabhupada's comment on that occasion. And so I was just, in the last couple of days, appreciating the wisdom of that. Well, appreciating the wisdom of that, not in the last couple of days, but just in the last couple hours since I've been asked to give the class, in light of this, that a couple of days ago, I was, I can't remember how the subject came up, but Sachin Anoy mentioned to me, he said, that you heard about, what's his name? All of a sudden, name's escaping me. Maharaj. You know, I forget, all of a sudden his name is escaping me, but this is our godbrother, my godbrother, Maharaj, has fourth stage cancer. Sorry? Gunagrama, sorry, just all of a sudden I couldn't remember his name. Yeah, so he mentioned that to me, and I went and went on to Dundabats, and I read the article, and yeah, sure enough, first when he said it, I couldn't believe it, because, you know, I know him, like, well, he's contemporary, about the same age as me, and I just thought, whoa, God. At first I heard it, I go, what? No, that can't be right. I read about it. And then, and I remember, like, there's one, anyway. So then, in the course, because I was already on the website, I just was reflecting on, wow, you know, this mortality thing is like, this is for real. I mean, it's not just like other people, you know, it's like your people, you know. I mean, to be honest with you, it's something I reflected on before. Once I made a list of all the people I knew. This was about 6 months ago. I compiled this list of all the people I knew who have passed away. And I stopped. It got too long and too depressing. I mean, I was like, you know, it was a really long list, like way over 100 people. And, you know, and a lot of them were just people I, you know, really knew, were friends with and had relationships with. And while I was there on the page, I just I went on to the obituaries. They actually have an obituary section on the Dundabats website, so I checked that out. And I saw there was this devotee who I didn't even know he passed away. His name was Sankirtan Das. He was a very nice devotee, disciple of Lokanath Maharaj. And, I went through some other, it goes back about 10 years. I was looking at some other people. I said, wow. And what came to my mind and what I was going to say this morning is we're almost dead. You know, we're almost dead. We shouldn't kid ourselves. Life is really short. I mean, it's really short at best. I'm 64. That means if I'm really lucky, I'm two-thirds through my life. That's if I'm really lucky. You know, I got another 32 to go. So if I make it to 96. So that's, you know, still I'm two-thirds done. And I might just make it till 66. I mean, if I'm, you don't know. I'm sure all these people who are finding out that they have some terminal disease or something like that, one day they're walking around thinking they're perfectly fine. They're just walking around thinking, hey, I'm okay. And then next, it's like from moment to moment, everything changes, you know. And of course, that's just with disease. Let's speak of accident or natural disasters or something like that. So we're almost dead. I mean, we're almost finished with this whole thing. You see? So it was a good advice that Prabhupada that gave on that occasion. He said, "Yeah, better just tolerate it if you possibly can." As I said, I'm not trying to diss the Grihastha ashram or anything like that, but if you possibly can, the more tolerant we can be of this sexual disturbance, the better it is. The better it is. That's really good advice. Because even when you do get married, as Prabhupada, and as that anecdote was vividly sort of indicating, you have to be pretty much celibate anyway. You know, I mean, compared to what people are used to, you know, in terms of what they think of in terms of enjoying sexuality by karmi standards, once a month, it's kind of like, you know, it's practically celibate. And once you do have a child, then you're not having sex life anymore. So practically, as a devotee, you got to be celibate. So anyway, that little bit of advice that Prabhupada gave on that occasion is really good advice and is really worth meditating upon and thinking about very seriously. So anyway, so reading on a little bit more here. Where was I? Okay, so so it says here, Mamata very much feared that being forsaken by her husband for giving birth to an illegitimate son, and therefore she considered giving up the child. But the demigod solved the problem by enunciating a name for the child. I won't read that purport again. And Brihaspati said to Mamata, "You foolish woman, although this child was born from the wife of one man through the semen discharged by another, you should maintain him." And she heard that. I mean, I get the impression here. She's insulted. She's, you know, She doesn't, what are you talking about? It's kind of like, oh, Brihaspati, you maintain him. After speaking in this way, Brihaspati, they both left, you know. So this is like really unexpected of, you know, a demigod who's the priest, not just a demigod, but he's the priest of the demigods. And, you know, that such an incident should take place is very remarkable. And then it points out here that although encouraged by the demigods to maintain the child, Mamata considered him useless because of his illicit birth, and therefore she left him. Consequently, the demigods known as the Maruts maintained the child, and when Maharaj Bharat was disappointed for want of a child, this child was given to him as his son. And Prabhupada says here that it's understood from this that those who are rejected from the higher planets are given a chance to take birth in the most exalted families on this planet Earth. So that brings the question to my mind, so did this kid get born twice? Because he was already born in the heavenly planets. Then when he was presented to Maharaj Bharat, how was he born again? I mean, anyway, but somehow or another he appeared in human society. So maybe in that sense he was he was rejected in the heavenly society, but he was given a chance to, you know, continue his life on the planet Earth. So, but anyway, the thing is this, that there's a lot of things like this in the Bhagavatam, things that are, when you read them, it's, at least when I read them, I kind of go, whoa, what's this all about? You know, I mean, how do I understand this? How do I relate to this? And how would other people relate to this? People who aren't, you know, devotees or general populace, how do they? Well, one thing that came to my mind was that most people, the way they would relate to this is, respond to this is, they won't. Because they don't know about this. You know, your average, unless you're a devotee, if somebody's not a devotee, they don't read the Bhagavatam. And if they do read the Bhagavatam, they don't read it like really thinking about it. Like even academic scholars and people like that, they don't read it scrutinizingly and study and think about what's being said. And devotees, we have this tendency of, because we're devotees, and as devotees, you can't find fault with what's in the Bhagavatam. It's not the duty of a devotee to look for defects or discrepancies or things that don't make sense or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in the Bhagavatam, you know, in the words of Vyasadeva or in the words of Srila Prabhupada, your spiritual master. So we tend to do a little bit just for, you know, for the sake of our own, you know, continuing as devotees, do a little bit like that story of the emperor who had no clothes. We tend to do that a bit, you know. You know, everybody knows that story. There was this emperor, he wanted the clothes, and the tailor came, and the tailor could see that this emperor was a bit of a fool, so he made him some so-called invisible clothes, right? And the emperor thought, okay, this is like awesome. These are the most subtle clothes that anybody's ever got. So one day the emperor paraded out into the kingdom there, and he was naked, you know. But they made a big announcement. Everybody, we're going to have a big parade because the emperor's going to come out in his new clothes. So when he came out naked, all the citizens were like, they're really nice clothes, you know. They're all afraid to say anything because, you know, you don't say that the emperor's got no clothes. He's the emperor. You know, who knows what will happen, what the, you know, repercussions of that will be. Except for one child, one innocent child just sort of went, Mommy, why is the emperor naked? And, you know, that blew the whole thing. Everybody realized, hey, wait a second. So we tend to do that a bit, you know, just kind of like turn a blind eye. But and that's, to a certain extent, that is a good way to respond to these kind of things. But and I'll just try to put that, leave that there and just put it in a bigger context. That here in 1976, maybe it was earlier, there was one instance where Prabhupada was up in his quarters up there, and a couple devotees, two or three devotees, I think it was two devotees, went up there, and they asked him about some passages from the Bhagavatam and Krishna book. One of them was, there was a few they brought up, but the one I remember is they asked him about how is it that King Nagnajit had 9 billion slaves, something like that, which was, what was it? Yeah, nine quadrillion bodyguards, which is like way more than the entire population of the earth today. Almost like 10 to the third, to the third power, something like that more. So Prabhupada said, why are you asking about that part of the Bhagavatam? I mean, there's no other part you want to inquire about? He said, well, Prabhupada, because people are asking us about this, you know, at Sankirtan. They did bring that up. They said that. And And they're asking about that. They don't ask about anything else. So the point was that the Prabhupada finally made, he was disgusted with them. He wasn't happy with them. They wasn't pleased that, you know, because he could detect that their attitude was improper. But he made the point to them that, you know, when we find things in the scripture, in the Bhagavatam, that don't tally with our mundane understandings, you know, our level, we shouldn't, try to think that there's some fault in the Bhagavatam. We shouldn't criticize or ridiculize or, no, we should just think that due to the level I'm on, I can't understand these things. You know, it's inconceivable. I can't understand it. And what I suggest is you put it in the car park. In other words, like when something that the 9 quadrillion bodyguards or something, and so many different examples like that, King Chittaketu having 10 million barren wives and on and on and on, okay? I just put it in the car park, which means that my response is, okay, I don't understand this. I mean, it's stated here, it's in the Bhagavatam, this is my religion, I am a devotee, I believe, I'm committed to this, but that's inconceivable to me. So what do? I'm just going to put it over there, and I'll get back to it later on. You know, it's a Tuk Shri Krishna Namadi, Nabhaved Gudayam Indade, Sevan Mukhi Hijivado, Svayameva Spratyada. That says in the Padma Purana that Krishna cannot be understood by the blunt material senses. He's understood by devotional service, beginning with the tongue. In other words, as you advance in devotional service, things get revealed to you. As you advance in devotional service, you'll get, you know, Tesham, how's it go? Tesham, Evana Kampartam, Mahamagyana Jamtamaha, Nasyami Atma Bhavashto, Jnana Dipena Bhashvata. Krishna says, to those who are constantly devoted and worship me with love, I give them the understanding by which they can come to me. Out of compassion for them, I who am dwelling within their heart, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. So as we advance in devotional service, Krishna, by his causeless mercy, will give us further insight, you know, understanding of how these things are true, how to understand them, how to relate to all the, you know, things that seem inconceivable and like impossible. That'll come. We have to be, as we mature in devotional service. So we shouldn't press the panic button when you come across these kind of things. No need to just glaze over them and just kind of like be like the ostrich who sticks his head in the sand, or the people who couldn't see that the emperor had no clothes on. You know, we can confront it, acknowledge, hey, wow, that's pretty far out. But no need to press the panic button, you know, and start, you know, allowing the mind to go, well, what is it? This is ridiculous. How could this possibly be true? No, just put it in the car park and, we'll deal with it later as time goes on. Another thing I do is part of my strategy to deal with these kind of things, because I don't know about anybody else, but when I read, I'm reading and I think about what I'm reading. I don't just kind of go, oh, yeah, blah, 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 and then, you know. I mean, I got to think about what I'm reading. So another way I deal with these types of things when they come up is I just remind myself how my overall commitment and conviction about Krishna consciousness. In other words, I remind myself, okay, you know, so I'm reading something like this, for instance, or, you know, those other examples I gave just off the top of my head. I remind myself, okay, well, I ask myself a question. Well, okay, have you ever experienced anything which would indicate to you that this is all true, you know, that Krishna consciousness really is the absolute truth and is all true? And the honest answer I, by Krishna's mercy, by Prabhupada's mercy, come back with is, well, yeah. What is that? Well, I've experienced a taste for chanting. What do you mean by that? Well, I'm chanting japa, and during chanting kirtan, not all the time, but sometime, and to varying degrees, and reciting verses I've memorized, I can honestly say to myself, you know, this is like a little exercise I do myself, I could honestly say that, yeah, I've experienced a higher taste. And then I ask myself, I know, like I said, it's like a conversation on that. And they say people are crazy if they talk to themselves, maybe. But anyway, I say, well, how's that possible? And if this wasn't the truth, how's it possible that just by chanting Krishna's name, you know, by chanting the holy names, by chanting shlokas that you've memorized and chanting in a kirtan, how's it possible that you could experience to me, it's not like a social, it's a distinct, different kind of pleasure. I know it's like Prabhupada would say, you're relishing the transcendental sound vibration. It's not mundane. I mean, I'm convinced it's not a mundane pleasure. It's a transcendental pleasure, spiritual pleasure, relishing the transcendental sound vibration. How could that happen if this was all false? Couldn't happen. at least as far as I'm concerned, it couldn't happen. So that's one very powerful thing that helps me. I remind myself of those fortunate moments when I've, you know, had that good experience of being able to relish the transcendental sound vibration. And another thing is, and I just reflect on the overall things I've learned from Srila Prabhupada and how, you know, they just sit totally comfortably and right with me. You know, the whole overall picture of Krishna consciousness, that human life is meant for understanding God, and, you know, we have to regulate our, control our senses. We have to, can't just be, you know, going after unrestricted sense gratification, and on and on and on and on. There's so many different, you know, points, things I've learned from Prabhupada that, you know, just completely, completely ring true and I'm comfortable with. And then, lastly, I remind myself that, well, you know, there is empiric evidence that supports this worldview, such as reincarnation, for instance. As kids remember past lives, it's something that was brought to my attention by devotees, so I don't feel guilty about having gotten so interested in it, but I did get interested in it, and I've studied up on it, and I really feel like, yeah, definitely, this is evidence that supports this, you know, our worldview, and that's significant to me, because it's that same evidence contradicts other major religious worldviews, which, you know, say could be competition for our, you know, our attachment or our, you know, being interested in. So, yeah. So the, you know, conclusion is that, two conclusions. One, dealing with specifically the point that Prabhupada's, you know, bringing up in these purports here about the human sexuality. Yeah, it comes up again and again. It's obviously a biggie. You know, Lord Brahma had a problem with it. Brihaspati's having a problem with it here. And I didn't bother to, I didn't have enough time and I didn't do research, but I probably could compile a list of another couple dozen names of major devotees who, you know, are being pointed out here in the Bhagavatam as had a problem with it, right? So it's a big one. And as I said, there's so many things could be said about it, but certainly one of them, one valid thing would be, as much as you possibly can, if you can just tolerate the itch and avoid the whole thing, you're doing yourself a great favor, because it's complicated. You know, it's trouble from beginning to end. You definitely, your life becomes more difficult, more complicated as soon as you go down that route of trying to satisfy that. I'm not saying that, you know, it's you're a bad person if you do or you can't. You know, you can and you're not bad, but it makes it more difficult. it doesn't simplify your life. It complicates your life. It makes things harder. It's like, you know, if you're going on a hike or something like that, if you want to do that and you're going up to the top of Mount Baldy or whatever, Mount Whitney or something like that, which is like a serious hike, you know, do you want to just go with the minimum amount of weight or the maximum amount of weight? Obviously, the minimum. You don't want to be weighed down by this, that, because it's the hike in itself, just to get your body from the bottom of that mountain to the top of that mountain, just to do that's going to be a difficult thing. That's going to take some doing. What to speak if you've got to carry a 20-pound backpack and this and that, and, you know. So it's the same sort of thing. Just to try to go back to Godhead is no mean feat. It's a biggie. It's a serious task, a serious thing to try to achieve. So, you know, what we should try to streamline the operation, keep it as simple as possible, and, you know, have as less baggage with this as possible, because it's just to, you know, to make it easier, because it is such a formidable task to start off with, and why make it any more difficult? So that's on that point. And on this other point about the far out things that come up in the Bhagavatam, yeah, once again, so, you know, Prabhupada told those devotees, you know, you should never have that attitude of like seeing some fault in the scriptures and Vyasadeva's presentation or the comments of the acharyas or anything like that. We should always consider, if we don't understand something, if we can't relate to something, if we're just thinking, wow, that's wacky, I mean, how do I relate to that? Just be humble, and it's your defect. The fault is with us. The fault is with us. We're not advanced. We're not elevated. We're not, you know, very knowledgeable in these scriptures or the Vedic culture, or what to speak of, highly realized. So just take the humble position. The fault's with me. If I just keep practicing Krishna consciousness, when I get purified, I'll have a more mature understanding. Things, you know, things will start falling in place more and more. Just have that attitude, and then you'll be safe. You won't be falling to the pitfall of, you know, becoming offensive and, you know, doubtful and so forth and so on. You'll be able to proceed comfortably on the path of Krishna consciousness. So I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Archita Prabhu. Yeah.
Hari Bol Prabhu. First of all, thank you for taking the class on short notice. Subhas was scheduled, but he had some incident last night, so he couldn't come. That's why Bhagavati Prabhu stepped in this morning. Now, you raised a lot of important points. I'm just going to go over a few. The main one is about asking questions. Yes, what we should read in a very inquisitive mood, and whatever we don't understand, we should want to understand.
Right.
But as we know, the overall guiding principle for asking questions in Krishna consciousness is approach somebody whose answer you're going to take. If you don't respect the person's position in terms of answering your question, then don't approach them. Whatever answer they give you, you should be willing to accept. And we know also you have to approach in a mood of service, it's humble mood and with a service attitude. We also should be ready to accept the fact that a person may not want to answer at that particular point for whatever reason. Prabhupada showed that many times. I'll just give a few examples quickly. The most far-out question that I can remember that somebody asked Prabhupada was about Arjuna and in relation to traveling with Krishna as his roadshow unfolds.
And they asked Prabhupada, Arjuna and his relationship
in relation to Krishna and traveling as his roadshow unfolds in the material world.
Got it.
One devotee wrote to Prabhupada and asked, is that the same Arjuna? Every time Krishna goes, you know, his pastime is unfolding all over the universe, all over the universes. Is that the same Arjuna? And Prabhupada said, yes. So that's completely far out. The jiva soul can expand and follow Krishna at every moment through that pastime.
Mm.
But there were other questions that devotees asked that Prabhupada did not answer. And the one that comes to mind most easily, readily, is that one devotee wrote that, or asked in person, I don't remember, that everything in the spiritual world is conscious. Prabhupada said, yes. The devotee said, so that means that the sweet ball is conscious. And the Prabhupada said, yes. So then the devotee said, well, what happens when somebody eats the sweet ball? And Prabhupada said, you just have to wait till you go there to find out. So Prabhupada didn't necessarily answer every question. Now, the particular incident that you brought up that happened here in New Dorka about the quadrillion bodyguards, nine quadrillion bodyguards, it was a special situation because the devotees were irreverent. They did not approach Prabhupada in the right mood. And later on, the particular devotee that asked that question fell down because when Prabhupada tried to dissuade him from following that line of logic, as you said, just accept Vyasadeva's presentation, he said, I don't believe that because where would they pass stool? Nine quadrillion bodyguards, where would they pass stool? In other words,
he wasn't submissive.
Yeah, he was not submissive and did not have the right attitude. And later on, that person fell down, unsurprisingly. Because you don't approach the spiritual master in that kind of irreverent mood. It's just not, you know, in America, in the West in general, we're trained like that, you know, to kind of be irreverent towards anything, religion or whatever. It gets us in trouble with the Muslims and others, you know, because you have this mood of irreverence towards anything spiritual or religious. So that person kind of still had traces of that, obviously. And Prabhupada did not appreciate it, and the mood became very, very tight. And literally that person got himself rejected by having that irreverent attitude towards asking questions arising in the Bhagavatam. So we should be very careful. Yes, there will be things that happen or you read that you don't understand. The guiding principle is approach somebody who's you respect enough that you're going to accept their answer. If you don't have that level of respect for the person, don't ask them the question. What's the use? Because you're not going to accept the answer anyway. So you're just wasting your time and their time. In other words, approach somebody on the level of your spiritual master or a shiksha guru whose answer you're going to take. Otherwise, don't bother them.
Yeah, thank you for that comment. I really appreciate that because, I mean, I brought it up because I thought it was an important point and you made two really important clarifications there. You can't have an irreverent attitude. You have to have a reverent attitude about what we're reading. And when you come across something that, you know, is a little bit difficult to comprehend, you got to approach somebody who you have respect for as being elevated and, you know, capable of giving you an answer that will maybe throw further light on the subject and be prepared to accept what that person says.
And if they don't want to answer, that's also acceptable. Like Prabhupada showed himself. Sometimes he would answer and other times he wouldn't. It's not that you think, what's wrong with this person? I asked a question, they don't want to answer. For whatever reason, maybe they detect something in your personality at the moment that they don't want to deal with.
Or your attitude.
They may not want to answer. You have to be ready to accept that also.
Thank you. That was great. Banabata Babu.
Prabhu, thank you for a wonderful, illuminating class on a couple of kind of difficult verses, and I thought you really explained them really, really thoroughly and nicely. One thing comes up into my mind is when Srila Prabhupada talks about how in Krishna consciousness one should understand the difference between following in the footsteps and imitating. And this kind of comes into the category of that. And so it's notable that although Brihaspati performed illicit sex and forcibly discharged woman semen in the womb of Mamata when she was pregnant, however, the child who was born was Bharadvaj, who's one of the seven great sages, one of the stars in the sky. He's the father of Dronacharya. So I thought that was also kind of significant, and you made explained very nicely how we can.
Yeah, well, thank you. That once again, you gave some further clarification. And I think I brought this point up in a previous class I gave. You can't imitate these persons. These are great. These are personalities that are super elevated, and we can't try to take their behavior and put it into our little box of understanding. You know, I think there's a verse like that. Dravida would know the Sanskrit about. You can't imitate the activities of the Ishwaras, you know, who are controlling the planets and this and that. Just try to appreciate and follow in their footsteps like that. So yeah, that's a good point. These are personalities in a different category, and you know, we have to always bear that in mind, and therefore that'll help us understand these types of things a little bit better, and not be so maybe disturbed by them in mind, because you know they're on a different level of they're evaluated by different standards. Thank you. That was really any modesties. Yeah, sorry, over there. Changing the battery. So just speak loud, and I'll repeat it.
Would take the renounced order of life sort of at the end of their marriage, but still within their marriage, you know, it's explained in the Bhagavatam that Kardama Muni had to expand himself 9 times because Devahuti wanted, you know, sex pleasure, and women are explained as 9 times more lusty than men. But still, at the end of their marriage, Kardama Muni still took renounced order. And by the end of their marriage, Devahuti was inquiring about the Absolute, and Kapiladeva went on to, you know, liberate her. And also, you know, Prabhupada explains in a purport that sex within marriage is still celibacy. So, you know, these are seemingly contradicting statements. So maybe you can just comment on that.
Well, like I said, it's not like it's the Grihastha ashram is a bona fide ashram, so it is. It's not like it's against Krishna consciousness if you have sex life according to religious principles, which is sex life for the purpose of procreation. That's Krishna says, "Kamosmi," you know, but that I am. So that's there, and but I was just making the point that you know, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, he also there's a quote from him where he said, "If I could produce Krishna conscious children, I'd have sex life 100 times, but obviously he didn't. You know, he remained a sannyasi, or a brahmachari and sannyasi throughout his entire life. So I'm not saying it's definitely bona fide, but it's difficult. It makes it harder. And that's the point I was making. If somebody wants to go that route, anybody wants to go that route, good. You're not outside of Krishna consciousness. You're not necessarily outside even the realm of pure devotional service, but it is something that can, I'm not going to say definitely will, but it can make things more complicated, can make things more difficult. And that's why I presented that example of this, you know, streamlining the operation. It's already something like, you know, I gave that example of you can try to hike up a big mountain. That in and of itself is difficult, so why take extra baggage? Why make it harder for yourself? You just take what you absolutely need, because, you know, it's already going to be hard enough just to get your body up there, what to speak of your body plus this, plus that, plus this, but that. That's just something to bear in mind. But if somebody feels like, well, I could do it. I'm strong enough, or I just need to bring this stuff, you know, then okay, go for it. You're not doing something that's outside Krishna consciousness or outside pure devotional service necessarily. But that's just my That was just my personal, you know, take on things. And I just, that was what I wanted to, based upon my experience, based upon, you know, all the different things I've read in the books and heard, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That was what I, the message I wanted to contribute to the Vaishnav community this morning. Is that okay? Thank you. All right, one last one, and then we'll break. Our dear God brother Satchanarayan Prabhu. Yep.
I just wanted to mention that one time Sadaputta mentioned to me that in his study of the fifth canto, that the Bhagavatam sometimes assumes a yogic or mystical vision on behalf of the people that are studying it. And this might, you know, help to understand or that we can't conceive things with our vision. The Bhagavatam sometimes assumes a multidimensional vision. So when we hear numbers like quadrillion, this may be beyond our vision. It doesn't mean it's not true.
Yeah, he elaborates upon that in that book he wrote, Vedic Cosmography and Astronomy. That's kind of one of the main themes of that book, you know, which is elaborated upon. Okay, so we'll stop there. Thank you very much. Grantar Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.